We're focusing on the low-wage workforce and how to address persistent turnover. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, thanks for being here. Frontline workers are often part-time, maybe seasonal, not in it for a tenure of packing boxes or delivering food, dipping cones, or washing dishes. A Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis survey of frontline workers late last year found 58% were looking for work with better pay. But the survey also found that work-life balance and job training in particular were really important. Have you ever felt trapped in a low-paying job? How should employers invest in frontline workers? And what does invest mean, by the way? 800-642-1234. Manjari Raman is director and senior researcher of the Managing the Future of Work Project at Harvard Business School, co-authored a recent report called Building from the Bottom Up. Manjari, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Good to be back here.
Good morning. So set the scene for us. How hard is it to keep the lowest paid workers on payroll right now?
You know, very respectfully, Kate, when you started the segment talking about how workers are all looking to get a better job and they're looking for opportunities outside their company, we surveyed more than 1,000 workers in low-wage positions across the country. And the signal we got from that survey was actually quite different. What we found was that many people are trapped in their low-wage positions and have actually stayed with the same employer in the same low-wage position for as long as 10 years or even more. So then we asked the question, why would you stay in a low-wage position? And one of the number one reasons people choose a particular job or a particular employer is how convenient is that employer to get to? Mm-hmm. What are my transportation needs? How conveniently is that job located? Once workers find a job that is convenient to get to, they signal very strongly, I want to stay. And so it's up to employers to value that and show them, here are the ways in which you can stay in the company, do more in the company, learn to move up to supervisor positions, even managerial positions. Here's the training you need. But unfortunately, we also surveyed 1,000 employers, and we found most employers are not doing any of this.
Hmm. Your study defines a low-wage worker as someone earning below $39,000 a year. Are certain industries worse than others with how they treat the lowest paid workers?
And just to put in context, the $39,000, that might look like a lot in a smaller town or a rural area across America. But if you're thinking about urban areas, that is, you know, it's $39,000 for a household of three. But keeping that in mind, these workers are actually quite concentrated in a few industries. Accommodation, food services, retail, and believe it or not, healthcare. Many EMTs earn below this amount. And it is shocking that these are the industries that tend to have many jobs, and many of those jobs tend to be low-wage jobs. So it's really challenging for companies who are in these industries because they are constantly seeing a churn. People are not happy in these positions. The jobs are difficult. You're standing physically on your feet. You're doing a lot of physical labor. There's a lot of stress. Very often you're facing the customer. And workers are just not being compensated enough for doing what they're doing.
Talking with Manjari Raman, director of the Managing the Future of Work Project at Harvard Business School, co-authored this report called Building from the Bottom Up. You can join in with your thoughts on what it means to invest in low-wage workers. 800-642-1234. Susan is with us from Westfield. Susan, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What is on your mind?
You know, I think definitely low-wage workers do deserve a lot more respect and work very hard. My experience has been, most maddening thing for me is lack of training. I have found that businesses lose more people. I've been more frustrated, and so many people I know just get so frustrated when you don't get trained properly. Training seems to consist of, look, here's how I do it, really, really quickly, and then walk away, and they come back 2 hours later wondering why you're still staring at the computer, wondering what your next step is. And it's very demoralizing when you don't get proper training.
Hmm. Susan, thank you for that. Manjari, what about training?
Susan is absolutely right. She's nailed it. What we found is that the top three things that employers are not doing is that there's no mentorship or supervisor feedback to workers. Secondly, workers are not told about the career pathways that exist for them in that company. And thirdly, they're not provided the learning and development and the training that they need to step up on those career pathways. So one of the questions we asked workers was, how many positions up can you see? And believe it or not, for a majority of these workers, they couldn't see beyond the next supervisor's position. Hmm. And that's ridiculous, right? Because all organizations have pathways, and you should be able to see three levels up and know that if I train and if I do this, I will get to the next level and my wages will be this at the next level. And you should be able to plan your career pathway. Unfortunately, that's just not the case. And the flip side of what Susan was saying is a real tragedy, because again and again in the survey, we found workers have a strong sense of agency. Hmm. They are not asking for a handout. They're just saying, please just tell me, what do I need to do? I will invest the time. I will put in the time to do the training, but just at least tell me, what is the training I need? And employers are not even providing that much.
We had a restaurant owner on our show recently, and I made a mental note to ask you about it. We were talking about teenagers filling low-wage jobs at her restaurant and how she really felt no remorse about their minimum wage. She said they're learning how to mop correctly, learning how to interact with customers, learning how to bus and set tables the right way, learning schedules. And because they are learning on the job, it's okay to pay them that minimum. And I wonder if that mindset creeps into attitudes about low-wage workers, that there is always this element of skill building, and therefore, because you're not totally proficient in every aspect of the work, it's okay to pay you less and perhaps, you know, take what you can just to get that labor. What are your thoughts there?
Kate, this is the fallacy with which we console ourselves, that people in low-wage positions are in entry-level positions and they are teenagers. Unfortunately, in our survey, we talked to workers. They were all over the age of 21. Mm. They were not young. Many of them were in their 40s and 50s and had been in low-wage positions their entire life. There is no... that was an old era where these were called positions where you could come in and learn how to mop and basic workforce skills. That era has gone. Now it's an era where people are stuck in low-wage positions. And unfortunately, when we say people, a large number of these workers in low-wage positions tend to be women and people of color. So it's a dual tragedy in that we have people who are caregivers, people who were, you know, previously incarcerated, people who don't have a four-year college degree, all kinds of people who have no other option but to stay in these positions. And you might ask, why do they stay in these positions? Because you know what? Not being in that position is a complete drop-off. Mm. It could mean homelessness. It could mean losing child custody. It could mean food insecurity. One of the most moving elements of the survey was we asked people, do you have the confidence to ask for a promotion? If you're not getting mentorship, do you go to your supervisor and ask for feedback? They don't. People are scared. Hmm. People are worried that if I ask for feedback and I get the wrong feedback, that you're not doing the job well enough, I have to leave. And then where do I go? So it's a truly poor situation. And on the flip side, employers are also paying the cost, because we found turnover in companies was more than 25% in these positions. So imagine, in many companies, it was going up to 50% and 75% a year. Hmm. Can you imagine your workforce constantly churning, wanting to hire?
Huge churn. So let's pause right here with Harvard Business School's Manjari Raman, leads the Managing the Future of Work project, out with an 83-page analysis of low-wage workers, how companies can better address this churn. What factors are most important to you in staying with a job? Does your company chew through its lowest paid employees? What happens to them? Do they leave or move up in the organization? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Manjari Raman here on the Ideas Network. New research out of Harvard Business School aims to help companies rethink how they view low-wage workers, who make up 44% of the American workforce. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In the pandemic especially, we've seen an onslaught of retention bonuses, of signing bonuses, referral bonuses. But the study authors say incentives alone won't solve the retention problem. So what will? Is your company scraping by with barely enough workers to cover shifts and continually having to train up new people? What is that like? 800-642-1234. Harvard Business School's Manjari Raman directs the Managing the Future of Work project, co-authored the study, and she's with us for 9 more minutes. Let's go to Ted now in Eau Claire. Ted, hi. What is your perspective?
Well, my perspective is that, everybody seems to look at the issue of employers trying to retain employees. But one of the things that gets missed over and over again, and this includes when the government is looking at trying to increase wages and that type of thing, one of the biggest problems that I see is the benefits. For a person who's making $39,000 a year, for a lot of corporations that are multi-billion-dollar corporations, these people have $6,000 a year that they have to pay in premiums for their family, and then have $12,000 to $13,000 deductibles. So what that does is it forces those people to be on public aid for their insurance, because they can't afford to have that type of a premium in insurance.
They can't afford to have the health benefits that the company is providing. Manjari, what do you see there in terms of benefits that these low-wage workers receive?
I think the biggest benefit, one of the questions we asked, we even asked folks, would low-wage workers like things like ESOPs, stock options in companies. Actually, the biggest benefits that workers are looking for is investment in training.
Hmm.
People feel their skills eroding. People feel the skills gap. People understand that their ability to aspire to higher wages is linked to their ability to be more productive. This is not just about, let's raise wages. This is about, how do you connect the link between productivity and pay? And people can only be more productive when somebody is making sure that they are learning how to be more productive. When they are more productive, it actually helps the company that they are working for. So the math, which is right now a fight to the bottom, always looking at workers as a liability and a cost, actually needs to be inverted on its head, where workers need to be seen as assets. Once you recognize that, I think your numbers start looking very different.
I found it interesting, too, that you found employees, they want some guidance from their employer on what skills they should learn and where they should go to get those skills, that it might not be at the university or college down the street.
It could be at the university, at the college down the street, at a community college, or it could simply be a few hours a day in terms of customer service orientation, for example.
Mm.
So a lot of times the opportunity that companies are missing out on is not looking at their workforce through a wider lens and say, what are the open positions in our organization? And do we already have some of the skill sets that we require in the organization? And now can we move people across the organization with a little bit of training and a little bit of, you know, more learning and development, maybe even just a little bit of supervisor support, and get them into a position to do a better job? A simple example is people working in housekeeping. It's increasingly we are seeing those in the accommodation services trying to look within the housekeeping staff to say, how can we now move them up to something which is in the front office? And in fact, when we looked at data on how low-wage workers change jobs, we find that people are actually jumping from industries, from different positions in industries.
Yes, I found that really interesting. You know, people who progressed, shifted industries, that, you know, a change in employers perhaps correlated with moving forward?
Yes. And that's because in many low wage positions, increasingly because of automation, the nature of low wage positions is becoming more complicated. It's no longer just the dirtiest, the hardest position. It's also now a position where you're expected to problem solve, communicate, team communications, deal with the customer. Those very quickly become quite sophisticated skills, what we euphemistically call soft skills. So workers who show strong tendency to have these soft skills are actually pure gold as far as the organization is concerned, because those are the skills that they want in all the positions across the organization.
Manjari Raman with us, co-author of a report looking at how employers can boost their entry-level workers, the report called Building from the Bottom Up. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Manjari, you found a disconnect between people senior in the company who say, look, we offer mobility, we offer all of this menu of things that our workers can do, but there was this disconnect as you go down the food chain, if you will, down to the supervisor level, that all of this, all of these opportunities get diluted in some way. What is going on there?
You know, this was one of these big eye-opener moments in the data. We made a list of about 60, more than 60 actions, right from the time a person is hired till the time they leave the company, asking questions on, you know, does your company do this? Does your company do this? Does your company do this? You know, do you get mentorship? Do you get supervisor support? Do you get training? 65 questions. When we asked workers, they came back with a strong no, 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 none of these actions have happened to me. Then we went to employers and asked the same questions. Are you performing these actions for your workers? And senior leaders, those who are in the C-suite, tended to say yes, many of the times. Middle managers tended to say yes less because they were closer to the reality. And supervisors who work closest with low-wage workers had the same reaction as low-wage workers. No, in my company, we're not doing any of these actions. So the irony is that senior management in many companies believes we've got the policy, right? Of course it must be implemented. Actually, it's nobody's job to worry about the implementation. So despite having the policies, due to poor implementation, workers are not getting the mentorship they need. Workers are not told about the career pathways. Workers don't know about the learning and development opportunities that they have. As a result, there's a high churn and the company pays the price.
In our last moments together, we know employers are going to be facing this tight supply of workers for a long time. We know Wisconsin in particular is an aging population. So as you give one last piece of advice to firms in Wisconsin about this reality, what can they start implementing today? What should they not wait on?
The number one thing is to recognize workers are an asset. And a worker who is already, remember, this was a survey, this was all research about workers who are already working for their company for 3 years or more. These workers have already signaled, we like you, we want to work with you, we want to stay here. it's up to the employer to recognize that there is all this goodwill. They want to be trained. They want to stay here and find ways to create career pathways. And the second thing I'd say is employers are actually now starting to be innovative, not just in terms of here's a better benefit or there's a $1 more higher salary, but actually starting to see what are career pathways? What can I do in my company? And if I can't do it in my company, how can I partner with someone outside my company to create career pathways for my workers? And actually, when you do something like that, the local community gets strengthened. You know, where do companies find workers? They find them from the local community, right?
Manjari,
Manjari, it's good to tell them that.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Manjari Raman, director of the Managing the Future of Work Project. We have a link to her report at WPR.org/mornings. News update is next. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Producer Mary Kate McCoy brings us a story about an app that helps users practice the Hmong language.
In the late 2000s, Apple popularized the phrase, "There's an app for that," highlighting the abundance of apps available for the iPhone. But when Annie Vang of Madison got into app development around the same time, she didn't see programs made in the Hmong language. Producer Hope Kerwin has more on the app she built and the way it's keeping native speakers and beginners connected to the language.
Eau Claire resident Tiffany Moore grew up speaking Hmong with her family, but as she got older, she started to lose some of her vocabulary and found herself struggling to remember words she didn't use frequently.
You know, you go to school, you speak English only. I didn't have any classes where they taught you in Hmong, so my Hmong language wasn't utilized as much as I had wanted to.
Moa was scrolling through Facebook one day when she saw a post about an iPhone app called Hmong Phrases. The app allows users to look up words and common phrases and hear an audio recording of how they're pronounced. Moa says she immediately downloaded it, hoping to test out her memory and her grammar.
When you grow up and you don't really speak fluent Hmong, you kind of create your own little sentences and you just formulate your own way of saying things, and it's not always correct. One that I do remember looking for was, "Can I pay for this?" Even now, like if I were to go shopping at like an Oriental store, I wouldn't know how to formulate this sentence properly.
The Hmong Phrases app was created by fellow Wisconsinite Annie Vang, who it turns out is also Moa's aunt. Vang is an iOS app developer from Madison, and she built the program 11 years ago after taking an app development course at Madison Area Technical College. Vang says she was inspired by advice from her professor, who encouraged her to build something she was passionate about.
Google Translate didn't exist at that time. And the Hmong language definitely was not in Rosetta Stone or any of the other language apps that were out there in the App Store. And so I took it upon myself that, you know, I want people to know who we are, who I am. And I felt that it was important to just, you know, have a presence in the App Store and leave a digital footprint of it.
11 years, constant updates, and one major rewrite later, the app now has over 4,000 downloads. Vang says she's always looking for ways to improve the program, taking feedback directly from users and from her parents, who are her primary beta testers. She says there have been some surprising requests from users about what they'd like to see added. She's been asked for more medical terms and Hmong names from people hoping to use them for babies.
They're interested in, like, how do you say a baby name? What does it mean? How do you pronounce it? And I thought it was kind of cool. So that's a feature that I'm currently building it right now, because we're such an oral language that if you just read the word, the name, you may not know how to pronounce it.
Beyond learning words and phrases, Vang says the app also allows native Hmong speakers to practice their intonation, an important part of the mostly oral language. She says young Hmong Americans often speak Hmong stiffly or struggle to hit the right tonal marks.
I can hear that a lot in like the kids that are growing up that are not speaking it like fluently with me being an elder. Even my nieces and nephews do the same thing, where when they say they're hungry, they're saying it like it doesn't have the right tone markers. And so you can understand what they're saying, but They may not know that they're saying it more English than Hmong.
This is something that niece and app user Moa says she appreciates about the program. Growing up, Moa says she spoke both English and Hmong to her parents, or sometimes a combination of the two, which she and other speakers call Hmonglish.
My parents knew enough of what I was trying to say that in the spot, because they understood it, they didn't say, oh no, you're saying that wrong. They'll just answer you.
Moa says she's not sure she'll ever fully master the Hmong language, but she's motivated to keep practicing so she can one day pass it on to her children and maintain the connection to her native language.
WPR's Hope Kerwin brought us that story about an app for the Hmong language. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
And now we go to our capital city, our next stop, meeting mayors from all over our state. Madison, home to about 270,000 residents as of the latest census figures. Its population growing by roughly 37,000 people over the decade since the 2010 census. What challenges have you encountered with housing, work, something else living in Madison? 800-642-1234. Satya Rhodes Conway was elected mayor of Madison in 2019, previously serving 6 years on the Madison Common Council. Mayor Rhodes Conway, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning and thank you.
Good morning. Let's start with the Gableman probe. For months now, the former Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman been investigating, as you know, the 2020 election, delivered his 136-page report yesterday to the Capitol. He wanted to force you and other mayors to comply with his subpoenas and turn over records. What is your reaction to what he produced?
Well, Kate, I haven't had a chance to read the entire 100 and however many pages, but just from the introduction, my reaction to that report is that it's full of lies and half-truths. And it's clear that Attorney Gableman doesn't understand the electoral process here in Wisconsin. He doesn't understand how city government works. And I question whether he even understands Wisconsin law.
What did you find problematic about being asked to be interviewed privately by Justice Gableman for this probe?
Well, this probe, fraud it, whatever you want to call it, is funded with taxpayer dollars. And I think that people of Wisconsin have the right to know what questions are being asked and how their money is being used. And I also don't think that this investigation is started or conducted in good faith. And it's not clear to me that the subpoenas that were issued can compel anyone to testify anywhere except in front of a legislative committee, which I've repeatedly said I'm happy to do.
Let's turn to the pandemic now. Dane County's mask mandate ended yesterday. Is this a good time for the mandate to end, or would you prefer to have it remain in place?
You know, Kate, all throughout the pandemic, we've stayed very closely in touch with public health and with the county because we have a shared public health department on tracking the data, understanding what the CDC is recommending, and, you know, looking what the impacts are in our community, particularly on our hospitals. And so we've tried to stay very focused on the science in looking at the public health orders. And I think we continue to do that. I think that many folks in our community will continue to wear masks when they feel like it's appropriate to keep themselves safe. And I absolutely encourage that. I think we need to, as a society, normalize mask wearing. And that folks, when they are not feeling well, should likely be wearing a mask in public to keep other people safe. Or folks who are worried about their own health or are immunocompromised for some reason should likely be wearing masks as well.
How has this been navigating mask wearing, you know, in a city where you have a very large flagship university with students coming from all over?
You know, we've just really had a great relationship with UW-Madison throughout the pandemic and have met at sometimes weekly with the chancellor and her staff. We're back to, I think, once a month now, but they've really done a great job, I think, in navigating the pandemic. And we've stayed in very close touch to try and make sure that we're coordinating and understand what each other are doing in terms of things related to the pandemic. One thing that I would call out about UW-Madison is that they've done a really great job in getting their folks vaccinated. And so their rates of vaccination are higher than the surrounding community. And even though Madison's rates are really high, the UW rates are even better. And so I think they've done a great job. You know, obviously it's challenging for them, but I think they've done a great job.
What can Madison and other cities take from their playbook, do you think?
Well, they have some advantages in that they have a defined population and they have a health service that, can require records from all of their students. Mm. And they've had multiple on-site vaccination clinics. So they have an advantage. But I think the basics remain the same, right? It's important for all of us to make sure that vaccination is broadly available, that we're communicating well about it, that we're taking the opportunities to get vaccinated to where people are. That's what we've tried to do in Madison with, I think, a very high degree of success.
Let's turn to ARPA funds. Madison received more than $47 million from the American Rescue Plan Act. How is your city using this money?
We were incredibly lucky to receive this money from the federal government. And I am thankful every day to President Biden for providing the ARPA funds. We're using about half of our money to keep our budget balanced. Our budget took a pretty big hit during the pandemic with lost revenue and increased expenses. And so approximately half of the funds we received are just going to keep our budget balanced last year, this year, and next year. The rest of it is going out into the community, and we're using it in a variety of ways. It is going to fund homeless services. Some of it will go towards various types of affordable housing. We've just last night allocated a good chunk of money to help our undocumented community and folks who are not able to access other types of federal pandemic aid. Some of the money has gone to meet people's sort of immediate emergency needs. We're investing in violence prevention. We're investing in our small businesses that have been impacted by the pandemic. And the list goes on. So this funding is really allowing us to address the impacts of the pandemic in a number of really important ways.
Madison Mayor Satya Rose Conway explaining the issues she takes on, where the ARPA funds are going. Do you live in Madison? What would you like to ask your mayor about how the city is run? What do you think that other cities can learn from Madison? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Mayor Satya Rose Conway here on the Ideas Network. We're meeting up with mayors from all over Wisconsin on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Today it's Madison on the isthmus between Lakes Mendota and Monona, area known as Desjopes, sitting on ancestral Ho-Chunk lands. What questions do you have about the environment? How should Madison lead to address the climate crisis? What should the city do to provide more affordable housing? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Madison Mayor Satya Rose Conway is with us for about 9 more minutes. You mentioned housing, homelessness, and the city taking now a new approach to deal with homelessness, investing in small shelters to temporarily house people. Can you tell us about this approach?
Absolutely. You know, one thing coming out of the pandemic that we realized is that we just have to transform our approach to dealing with homelessness here in Madison. And it just was not acceptable anymore for us to be essentially warehousing people in church basements. As grateful as we are to the churches who took this job on, we really need to take a different approach. So Madison is working on a number of fronts. We did stand up a temporary men's shelter We've created a new family shelter. We're on track to build a permanent purpose-built men's shelter, which is, I think, hopefully will be transformative for our approach to homelessness. But as you say, we've also invested in individual shelters. They're called pallet shelters in a village out on our east side that allows people to who are not willing to go into a congregate shelter to have a roof over their heads and to get access to services and to get stabilized and hopefully move into a more permanent housing situation. And just say, so far it's been very successful. We do have folks that are moving out of this village into more permanent housing already, which allows other folks to move in and take advantage of the services that are available. And so I'm very pleased with our initial success here, and I hope it continues. And we're just going to continue to do what we need to do to make sure that we're addressing the needs of people that are experiencing homelessness in our community.
Has it gotten worse in the pandemic?
Absolutely. Yes, we've definitely seen a rise in people experiencing homelessness. And that's not surprising. That's something I think we see across the nation. And with the economic fallout from the pandemic, many, many more people have been experiencing housing insecurity. And in addition to the work we're doing on homelessness, we're also working very closely with the state and federal governments to provide rental assistance to folks who might be in need, might be facing eviction, or just might not have the ability to pay their rent. And at that also, I think, has been a pretty successful program. And we've been able to get millions of dollars out into the community to help people stay in their homes.
Along those lines, affordable housing, lack of housing, we've talked with mayors all over. This is a huge problem. What is Madison doing to tackle the affordable housing issue and just not enough different types of housing?
Yeah, this is a crisis for our city, as it is for many others. We know that right now, to have a healthy vacancy rate in our rental market, we need approximately 4,000 units of new housing just today. And then going forward every year, we estimate that we need to add between 1,000 and 2,000 units a year. We're not anywhere close to that. So we need to be building more housing. We need to be building more affordable housing. The city has increased our investment in affordable housing every year that I've been mayor significantly. We're leaning into supporting tax credit projects, but we're also trying to spur innovation in providing other types of affordable housing through our Affordable Housing Fund. We've changed our zoning to make it easier to build different types of buildings and different types of housing. And we're just going to continue to use every tool in our toolbox to try and get more affordable housing here in the city of Madison, including preserving the housing that we've got.
Where are developers on this front? What have you heard from developers and the projects that come together and the ones that don't?
You know, I think we've been really successful in partnering with our development community around affordable housing that is funded through tax credits. We have been very successful in leveraging the federal low-income housing tax credits here in Madison. And I hope we'll be able to continue to do that because that's been a good, strong partnership. I think, you know, there's often frustration from the development community about the standards that we have here in Madison. And I think there's frustration in the perceived opposition of some of our neighborhoods to building housing or to building more affordable housing. I think that's really a mixed bag here in Madison. I think there are many people in Madison that are supportive of building more affordable housing. And sometimes they aren't the loudest voices. But we'll continue to work with our development community, particularly around the creation of affordable housing.
We're talking with Mayor Satya Rhodes-Conway, Mayor of Madison. You can join in 800-642-1234. Your city is doing this sweeping redesign of the Metro Transit bus system, largest overhaul ever by mid-next year, I think. What does this entail?
Well, so our transit system historically had been built up around folks that commute into downtown or to campus. Which is great. We've had great ridership on our transit system, but that doesn't meet everybody's needs. And increasingly, we're seeing our employment centers not be downtown and lack in transit service. So With the coming bus rapid transit system that will provide a fast, frequent service through sort of the east-west corridor here in Madison, we thought it was time to look at our entire system and ask the question of how do we best serve folks that are trying to get to employment and other destinations from everywhere in the city. And so we wiped the slate clean. We have been having a large conversation with our community about what their priorities are for transit. And we're now in the process of looking at a draft map and getting feedback on that. I'm very excited about what this means. It looks to me like we are headed towards providing more frequent transit that will get people to where they're going more quickly and will allow people to reach more destinations, particularly employment destinations across the city.
Let's leave some space here for climate. You signed the Better Climate Challenge this week, cutting emissions by 50% by 2030. How will Madison get there?
Well, we are already at 75% of our 100% renewable goal, approximately. We've been putting up solar everywhere that we can on every roof that we own, and we'll continue to do so. We've got about over a megawatt installed already. So we're leaning heavily into local distributed renewable energy, but we're also electrifying our fleet and using biodiesel where we can't use electricity, and you know, leaning into the efficiency of our buildings. So, you know, we're going to take all of the approaches that we need to reduce carbon, particularly in the building stock and in the transportation sector, which we know are the two largest emitters. But we also are trying to reach out into our community with programs like Madison to make sure that folks in the community and businesses have the opportunity to use renewable energy as well.
What is Madison, very quickly?
So Madison, Madison, is our program to help promote solar throughout our community. So we facilitate a solar group buy where individual property owners, homeowners will get together and lower the price of solar by going in together. We also have solar grants for nonprofits and for local businesses.
And finally, the contaminant PFAS been detected in every Madison well, although levels remain below the hazardous threshold. What is the city doing about PFAS?
This is a really serious issue for our community. We're very concerned, not just about our drinking water, but also about our surface waters. So we are hopeful and building out a plan to access the funds from the bipartisan infrastructure law, many of which can be used to address contaminants like PFAS. We do have one of our wells shut down now and are looking for how we can treat that well in order to reopen it. And again, we're going to hope to partner with the federal government to make that possible. And then we're working, you know, with the DNR, with the county, with the airport to address the historical PFAS contamination at the airport and in hopes of limiting the further contamination. And I should say that we're trying to eliminate our contributions to PFAS. We've switched, for example, from a PFAS-containing firefighting foam to one that doesn't contain PFAS.
And Mayor, we have to leave it there. Thank you for joining us, Satya Rhodes Conway, Mayor of Madison, here on the Ideas Network.